Astory Publishing presents Works for Hearts 2. Prologue. Winter 1964 had come down hard on New England, hard enough that the Atlantic seemed to inhale and hold its breath. In Washington, the new Great Society bills were being argued over like children's toys. In Saigon, the sky shimmered with rotor wash. In every living room, the gleam of console television sets made snowstorms and moonshots equally distant flickers. But in Concord, Massachusetts, the season's true broadcast arrived without antenna or fanfare. First, a cold, metallic scent stealing through split clapboards, then the hush of snowpack thickening on every roofline until the whole town sounded padded, careful, reverent. From 5,000 feet, the place looked no larger than a toy village. White steeples, an oval commons, streets laid with the tidy geometry that older maps called gambrel, and younger ones called suburb. Children sledded a railbed abandoned since steam locomotives fell out of favor. Their shouts drifted up, smudged by weather, then vanished. On the far side of town, just beyond the cemetery where revolutionaries slept beneath slanted stones, a square brick building kept its own quiet vigil. Emerson Hospital, 1920s vintage, boiler always on the edge of a cough. Two wards, three floors, a solarium that faced north by mistake. The place smelled, depending on the hour, of carbolic boiled cabbage or Mr. Alves's gleaming lemon wax, an olfactory calendar patients learned better than the date. Inside that squat citadel, the rumor mill turned quicker than the blood centrifuge. Beds might be added, budgets slashed. A new administrator could arrive with briefcase and memo pad, talking in the polished dialect of liability. Yet certain constants survived the red ink. Nurse Pauline Mercado's cardigan, forever stretched at the cuff. The pudding cart that wandered the corridors like a tame beast, and room 214 itself, a corner chamber with one cranky radiator and a view of the parking lot that in winter twilight passed for something almost pastoral. The nurses called it the way station. Not ICU, not quite ordinary, just far enough from the nurses' station that a lonely heart could sleep without the tyranny of alarms, just close enough that help came running if the silence turned too deep. Three blocks south, Main Street worked at the last honest crafts. Shoe repair, a barbershop still sweeping hair into sawdust, and, anchoring the row, Bauer Hardware. Orange wood stove glow behind the plate glass, a brass cash register that rang like Christmas every time the drawer opened. James H. Bauer, proprietor, believed in spare parts and second chances. The war had spared him. The factory accident had not spared his wife, and now grief rode his shoulders like a rucksack nobody else could see. He filled the empty rooms of his house with practical chores, re-oiled a squeaky hinge, labeled coffee cans of screws, but each task ended sooner than the ache. December's shortening light only made the hours more echo-laden. On this particular Christmas Eve afternoon, he stood at the workbench cutting key blanks while the radio fought static from a distant Boston station. Sawdust drifted onto his knuckles like miniature snow. Copper shavings winked in the bulb's halo. Beneath the counter lay a paper bag containing three late tomatoes coaxed from a desperate cold frame. Fruit that should have frosted weeks ago, but through patience and a makeshift tarp, had survived. They were headed to Emerson Hospital by sundown, though Jim would have insisted he'd merely be dropping them off, the same way one says, just resting my eyes before sleep overtakes. Miles in the other direction, Nurse Mercado counted out hypodermic caps with the precision of an abacus. 35, 36, the number steadied her pulse more than coffee ever had. She'd promised her three daughters a quick supper and a storybook before heading on shift, but the laundromat had eaten her last quarter and the bus ignored the slush-clogged curb, so she jogged the final half mile, breath fogging. At the staff entrance, she paused, palms on knees, while the overhead bulbs buzzed like summer cicadas. Then she straightened the constellation of freckles across her nose, smoothed the cardigan sleeve she always twisted when worried, and crossed the threshold where linoleum began and outside troubles, theoretically, stopped. In the physician's lounge, Dr. Elias Hollis adjusted a pair of novelty cufflinks, tiny silver wreaths, each no bigger than a nickel. He owned dozens, stethoscopes, snowmen, even miniature tabloids that opened to scandalous headlines only he could read. Tonight, he had traded the lot for the wreaths, thinking they struck the right balance between gravitas and mischief. Hollis believed laughter shortened the distance between systole and diastole. He also believed, privately, that loneliness was the quiet arrhythmia. He had seen enough angiograms to recognize the way sorrow traced its own narrowing path. His docket for the evening was mercifully light, and his thoughts kept wandering to room 2/4 me, the walls he'd measured last January for a botanical print no budget ever approved, the window he once cracked at 3 a.m. so a dying man could smell fresh snow. Upstairs in administration, Gerald A. Carmichael, J.D., newly installed director of compliance, practiced signatures. The pen he favored bled blue ink, so vivid it looked lit from beneath. He liked numbers because they stayed put. He disliked deviations, especially holiday deviations. Half-day admissions for observation only, pudding carts clogging egress routes, telephones tied up by nurses singing harmony, none of it aligned with his charts. Somewhere below, the second-hand furnace rattled. Carmichael considered the projected heating overage and scrawled a note, "Monitor energy use, fourth floor." Then, for reasons he could not have articulated, he underlined the line twice. Snow began in earnest at 3:15, fat flakes that spun like drowsy moths around the lampposts. Emerson's windows blurred into cottony glow, and the town's plowed roads narrowed to wagon tracks. The world outside folded in on itself, pushing lives toward a single glowing nucleus. By 4, headlights gleamed off drifts like coins at the bottom of a fountain. By 5, the hospital parking lot looked less like asphalt than a field awaiting seed. Across town, Jim checked his watch, found it later than he feared, and set the key cutter back on its hook. In his coat pocket, the folded envelope from July, the tomato delivery thank you signed by Nurse Mercado and countersigned by Dr. Hollis, had softened with rereading. He tapped it once, as though reassurance were percussion, then reached for the shop lights. On the hospital's third floor, Pauline stubbed a pencil, catching herself halfway through, drawing a holly leaf in the margin of the daily census. She tore off the sheet, tucked it in her breast pocket to amuse the girls later, and fetched a clean form. Charts must look proper, especially tonight, when eyes that cared about costs would hunt for excess. Two floors beneath, Hollis, white coat off, wool peacoat on, climbed the service stairs instead of taking the elevator, using the empty flights to rehearse phrases that balanced clinical authority with seasonal comfort. Somewhere in the walls, steam clattered like coins dropped down a chute. He imagined greeting an imaginary auditor. "Yes, Mr. Carmichael. Pulse irregularities spike in isolation. We have elected to treat with the cardiotonic properties of company and colored bulbs." At the edge of town, Jim's truck coughed alive, muffler rattling like sleigh bells left out in the thaw. He let the engine idle, defroster wheezing against the fogged windshield, and considered the evening ahead, the lobby resin smell, Pauline's peppermint lotion, Dr. Hollis's half-smile. And beyond that, a room whose door had squeaked for decades, but never so loudly as when it opened to let him rest. In administration, Carmichael capped his pen, satisfied with the day's projections. He folded the latest directive, no non-critical overnight admissions without prior authorization, and slipped it into the out tray. Tomorrow, perhaps, he would deliver it in person. Tonight, there were roads to brave and protocols already in place. Still, he paused at the office window long enough to notice a lone set of headlights turning into the side drive, tires chewing fresh powder. He tapped the pane with one manicured fingernail, an idle Morse code of suspicion. Street lamps flickered. The storm knotted tighter. Somewhere in the dark, a volunteer choir cleared throats for midnight service. Somewhere else, a child pressed a face to frosted glass, waiting for proof of reindeer. And converging on the brick heart of Concord came a widower with tomatoes, a nurse with pockets full of unfinished sketches, a doctor who trusted humor more than policy, and an administrator whose pen believed in lines that did not bend. Within the hour, one of them would step across the threshold of room 214 and tip the first small domino that would not stop falling for years, spilling hymns into hallways, sprouting gardens from pavement, turning a ward meant for aches and murmurs into something braver. But Snow kept its own counsel, and the walls of Emerson held their breath, and the question floated like a flake unclaimed by ground or sky. When the clock struck Christmas, who would decide how much comfort a human heart was allowed, and who would dare to give more? End of prologue. Snow had been falling since noon. Concord, Massachusetts, 24 December 1964. Dusk gathered in soft folds, the last of the daylight, bruising the snow clouds a lavender gray that seemed to cling to the rooftops like a damp mist. Along Main Street, iron lampposts wore shaky halos, their light diffused by the gently falling snow, and the tired Studebaker parked outside Bauer Hardware puffed exhaust that curled like ghostly ribbon candy before dissolving into the cold. The air was heavy with the scent of wood smoke and pine, carried on the whispers of snowflakes that danced around the streetlights, their delicate flakes settling on the pavement like a layer of fragile lace. Inside, Jim Bauer coaxed the brass key from the register and let the cash drawer sigh shut for the night, the sound echoing through the shop like a tired sigh. He did not hurry. A man in a rush leaves fingerprints on everything. Jim preferred gentler evidence. A broom leaned at the exact angle his late wife once favored, a neat row of paint swatches aligned to the inch, their colors muted in the fading light. The radio over the cutting bench crackled. "I'll be home for Christmas," through more static than melody, the tinny notes mingling with the scent of pine shavings and old motor oil that clung to the shop like a comforting blanket. Jim's shoulders tightened on the downbeat, then slumped as though someone had tugged unseen wires. He reached for the receipt pad, thumb hovering over an indented scrawl of initials, M.B., Marion Bauer, half erased by months of reorder sheets. The memory of her handwriting, once as familiar as his own, now felt like a ghostly presence, a reminder of what was lost. He traced it, but did not press hard enough to leave new marks, his finger lingering on the faded letters as if seeking a connection to the past. The rough texture of the paper beneath his touch was a tactile reminder of the countless transactions that had taken place on this counter. The shop smelled of pine shavings and the dull sweetness of old motor oil, comforting in its ordinariness. Yet grief prowled the corners, patient, tireless, its presence felt in the silence between the radio's crackles. Jim slipped a cracked steel tape measure, hinge sprung in two places, into his breast pocket, the familiar weight a homespun talisman that brought a small measure of comfort. Then he turned off the overhead fluorescents one by one, letting the window display carry the rest of the light. Red and green bulbs framing a hammer suspended by fishing line so it appeared to float above a tin toy train. Marion had arranged that window last year, humming her off-key alto while the snow came down heavier than this. The memory of her laughter and the scent of pine lingered like a benevolent echo. As the lights dimmed, the shadows in the shop deepened, and the silence grew thicker, punctuated only by the occasional creak of the old building. When the front door clicked shut behind him, Jim locked both deadbolts, tried the handle twice, and listened to the quiet until the blood in his ears settled. Concord Common lay white and empty beyond the plowed curb, Christmas Eve still an hour from full dark, but already stripped of bustle. Families had gone indoors to board game laughter and stovetop cider, the warmth and light of their homes a contrast to the cold, darkening street. He stood there, the snowflakes settling around him like a shroud, and felt the weight of his decision. The cold air stung his cheeks, and the snow crunched beneath his feet as he moved. He was not going home. The decision, though rehearsed, pinched. He touched the pocket almanac tucked near his ribs, July's ink circle around plant's second batch of tomatoes. That memory opened of its own accord, transporting him to a summer day when the air was thick with humidity and the scent of ripe tomatoes. Last July, humidity thick as chowder, Jim backing his Ford half-ton to the loading dock behind Emerson Hospital with bushels of early girls in the bed. The sun beat down on him, warming the metal of the truck, and the scent of tomatoes filled the air. He'd wiped dust off the side mirror with a shop rag, still smelling faintly of turpentine, the odor yanking him back to his father's garage. Pauline Mercado, cardigan tied around her waist, had clocked out and jogged up the ramp, ponytail escaping its ribbon, freckles brightening as she smiled. "Thought I smelled tomatoes," she'd called, vowel flattening the O. "These for the cafeteria or for bribery?" "For whoever's hungry," Jim had answered, lowering a crate. Sun caught the freckles on Pauline's nose. She squinted, grinned, commandeered the box, her hands moving with quiet confidence. Elias Hollis had appeared next, tie tucked between second and third buttons, spectacles fogged with sweat, his eyes crinkling at the corners as he smiled. "Mr. Bauer, your horticulture once again shames our so-called salad bar." Dry, precise, yet wry at the edges, his voice was balm. They'd unloaded together, Pauline shaking off her Boston lilt long enough to challenge the doctor. "You want honest vegetables, Hollis. You plant 'em." "Miss Mercado, interns are merely trying to master gelatin." The man had a gift for mock dignity, and Jim had chuckled. Back in the present, Jim let the scene exhale. Snow scratched faintly at his wool cap, each flake a tiny whisper of that fearless July heat. He took a deep breath and made his way to the payphone in the stockroom. The hardware store's payphone sat in the tiny back room where furnace pipes clanked like old bones. Jim dialed the hospital, turning the rotary slowly, pause on each number as though persuasion lay in deliberation. "Emerson Hospital, fourth floor nurses station," answered a woman, voice lilting. "It's Jim. Pauline there?" A shuffle, the hush of a hand covering the receiver. He pictured Pauline twisting her cuff while she waited. "Hey, Mr. Bauer," she said at last, softer than daylight. "Cold night." Silence ballooned. Jim cleared his throat. "Reckon I've got a flutter in the chest again." It wasn't entirely false. Grief often disguised itself in the body. Another pause, long clinical weighing of ethics versus friendship. Then, "Come through admitting. Room 214's open. Dr. Hollis is on call till midnight. Bring warm socks, the ward heater's on strike." He set the receiver down gently, as if a loud noise might break the fragile permission he'd been granted. The bell above the back door rang when he stepped into the alley, snow squealing under his boots like a chorus of mice. The half-ton started after three tries, engine catching with a cough. Driving east along Elm Street, he passed houses where windows pulsed television blue. Rudolph or Bing Crosby, no doubt. He increased the heater fan, though it spat only tepid air and chewed a cinnamon toothpick until the bark splintered. Parking at the hospital, Jim took a moment. Emerson rose squat and brick against the falling night, windows lit unevenly like a checkerboard. He retrieved a small paper bag from the passenger seat, three late-season tomatoes coaxed from the cold frame, skins mottled but whole, and tucked it beneath his coat. Inside smelled first of salt on rubber mats, then of disinfectant pitched high with wintergreen. Mr. Alves, night custodian, buffed a stretch of corridor, his buffer whirring like an obedient hound. "Evening, Jim," he said without pausing, accent lilting Portuguese. "Careful, floors slick till they set." "Shiny enough to skate," Jim answered. Fourth floor, the elevator rattled like a tin drum, slow, insistent. Doors parted to a hush, fractured only by shoe squeaks and some far-off monitor beep. Nurse Callahan glanced up from a chart, smile a quick crescent. "Pulse is dashing through the snow already, Mr. Bauer," she teased. "Could be." He tried matching the grin, but felt the muscles misfire. "Medication pass. She'll find you." Callahan nodded toward 214. "Got the good view of the parking lot tonight." Room 214 waited, pale and half-lit, the overhead bulb flickering then steadying. Bed stripped, except for a folded blanket, wheels protesting each bump as Jim pulled it toward center. The squeak Marion once compared to a mouse with laryngitis made him huff a quiet laugh. He shucked his coat, draped it over the visitor chair, and placed the cracked tape measure on the nightstand beside the tomatoes. The cool metal beneath his touch was a tangible connection to his past. Footsteps. Pauline leaned against the frame, cardigan sleeves pushed to elbows, eyes warm. "Told you about socks," she murmured, gaze landing on his snow-wet laces. "I listened halfway." She produced a blood pressure cuff. Formality. When contact came, her fingers sliding beneath his sleeve for pulse, Jim sensed how small any lie was compared with the soft authority in her touch. The cuff hissed, numbers printed themselves. She studied his face a moment. "Hollis'll swing by," she said at last. "I'll bring tea once I finish meds." The door eased shut. In the hush, Jim traced ceiling tiles cracked in spiderwebs, listening for his heartbeat and hearing only the building breathing, pipes ticking, vents whispering. 10 minutes later, Dr. Hollis arrived, coat unbuttoned, novelty cufflinks shaped like miniature wreaths glinting. He carried a clipboard and the faint smell of pipe smoke, despite bands. "Mr. Bauer," he said, settling on the chair, "chest discomfort, sudden onset, alleviated by the notion of institutional food. Is that correct?" "Figured I'd let the experts decide," Jim replied. Hollis's gaze warmed. "We'll keep you overnight. Run precisely zero invasive tests. Prognosis excellent." From down the hall, a volunteer choir practicing for midnight service loosed the first bars of "It Came Upon a Midnight Clear." The harmony drifted through grates and under doors, soft but insistent, like light sneaking beneath an old barn wall. Hollis tapped the rhythm on his knee and stood. "Rest, Jim. You're among friends. And Merry Christmas, in whatever measure you'll have it." When he left, the fluorescent hummed steady accompaniment to the carol. Pauline reappeared with a mug smelling of chamomile and peppermint. Steam curled. She set it next to the tape measure, noticed the tomatoes, and raised a brow. "Could have called a florist," she murmured. "Winter crop," he said. She smiled and exited. Jim sipped. The tea was too hot, but heat felt necessary. Outside the window, fresh snow covered his truck's bed, clean, indifferent. He slid onto the mattress, shoes off, blanket pulled to the collarbone. Choir voices swelled, the elevator dinged somewhere distant, and Mr. Alves's buffer thrummed faintly like a lullaby. In that half-lit room thick with peppermint and the ghost of pine, Jim let eyelids fall. For the first time in weeks, grief loosened its jaw. Not gone, never that, but gentled, at least for tonight. The hymn rose toward its final chord as his breathing slowed. By the time the sopranos reached Peace on the Earth, Jim had slipped into an uneasy yet welcome sleep. Hours drifted past. Somewhere beyond the darkened window, Christmas tipped into its sacred hush. The faint strains of O Come Emmanuel drifted through the hospital corridors, mingling with the scent of disinfectant and the quiet tick of the wall clock. Jim's eyes, heavy with the weight of the day, drifted closed as the chapel choir's distant hymn wrapped around him like a soft blanket. In the nurse's station, the staff huddled, their faces aglow with flashlight beams and a faint sheen of exhaustion. Pauline, her Boston accent softening the edges of her words, laughed as she sorted through a bin of lost and found items, freckles scattered across the bridge of her nose like a constellation. "What's the treasure trove tonight?" Nurse Callahan asked, warm contralto edging her smile. "Tarnished tie clips, a single opera glove, and a harmonica with a cracked reed," Pauline replied, holding up each item in turn. "We can work with this." As they improvised a gift exchange, the room filled with laughter and the rustle of wrapping paper, actually an old issue of Life magazine with a torn cover. Jim watched, a slow smile spreading across his face, as the staff turned junk into gifts. Dr. Hollis, spectacles slipping down his nose, presented Jim with the harmonica. "For the melancholy serenades," he said dryly. Jim's fingers closed around the instrument, feeling the cool metal and the rough edge of the cracked reed. Maybe I'll play for the ghosts, he thought. At midnight, Hollis steered Jim to the empty solarium, shoes creaking on linoleum. The janitor, Mr. Alves, buffed floors outside, the hum of the machine and the scent of wax providing a soothing backdrop. Inside, the darkness was lit only by the faint city glow casting a grid across the floor. They sat, sipping coffee from styrofoam cups, spoon clinking as Hollis stirred. Rooms answer in different keys, Hollis said, voice low. Some speak in beeps, some in breathing. Yours, tonight, speaks in second chances. Jim's gaze dropped. I didn't expect. The words drifted away. Hollis waited, silence patient. Just then, the elevator doors slid open, and Pauline wheeled out a floral tray, the scent of turkey and gravy mingling with disinfectant. Midnight snack, she announced. Nurse Callahan followed, delivering a pun that made Jim chuckle. Your vitals are jingle-bell-eyed normal, Mr. Jim. As the night wore on, the staff dispersed, leaving Jim to watch the sky lighten. At dawn, preparing for discharge, he touched the cold window pane. Outside, snowflakes danced in the morning light. With a sense of promise, Jim stepped into the fresh snow, the memory of the candlelit corridor lingering like a warm ember. Spring crept into memory and bowed out again. Routine pulled the calendar toward another December. Jim flattened two strips of cellophane tape with the side of his thumb, sealing a crayon-bright card to the brass till. The register drawer clinked shut, and the card, a riot of stick figures labeled Lily, Rose, Maggie, crinkled where the tape pinched the paper. A purple snowman leaned at a brave, improbable angle beside the blocky scrawl, "We miss your tomatoes, Mr. Jim." The O in tomatoes had sprouted lopsided holly leaves. Outside the plate glass, December twilight pressed its face to the window, turning every streetlight halo into a shaky crown. Jim's breath fogged the pane as he stepped back to judge the placement, dead center, eye level with customers who would never see it. Bauer Hardware had closed an hour ago. He was decorating for an audience of one. From the pegboard behind him, a dozen tiny envelopes hung on a bent, finish nail. Their corners were soft from handling. Faint tomato leaf scent still clung to the paper. A grease-smudged postcard from Jim, a line drawing of a wrench captioned Works for Hearts 2, had elicited a reply on floral stationery, rose-colored ink splotched where Lily's elbow bumped the bottle. A shoebox smelling of potting soil had arrived later, packed with marigold seeds and a folded note from Hollis. For the alley behind the store, medicine grows everywhere. In August, three mason jars rattling in shredded newspaper delivered Jim's crushed tomato sauce, lids sealed tight, condensation fragrant inside the delivery van. He touched the bent nail now, as though the letters might hum. Then he switched off the fluorescent row, leaving only the window display lit by a string of thrift store bulbs he'd rewired two nights ago. Red, blue, orange, green, they winked against a snow shovel and a coil of nylon rope, merchandise-turned-manger scene. He locked up, deadbolt top, padlock bottom, and listened until the hardware smelled only of cold iron. On the sidewalk, the air tasted of flurries and chimney soot. He walked the half-block to his truck, carrying a brown paper bag that sweated through at the bottom where a single potted poinsettia leaked water. Elm Street unfurled, dark and salted. He let the truck warm while he fished a cinnamon toothpick from the visor and cracked it between molars. Two blocks gone, he caught himself humming. The tune stumbled, it came upon, and vanished. 1 year after Marion's anniversary, and still the hymn snagged his throat. Concord's outskirts gave way to the low brick silhouette of Emerson Hospital. Jim parked under a lamp that buzzed like a moth trap and studied admission's double doors. Same ritual, different calendar page. A pulse of doubt. Maybe he should have stayed home, filled the stoop with poinsettias, cooked the sauce he kept promising Pauline's girls. But the house, with its ghost-quiet radiators, had felt carnivorous. Inside, rubber mats squelched. The lobby pine wreath was new. Commercial, stiff, yet the sharp scent kicked up memories of his own woodlot. He signed the clipboard, name, DOB, reason for visit, scribbling observation because Hollis had whispered, "Never write loneliness. Administration doesn't have a code for that." A volunteer offered water. He accepted, noting the aftertaste of styrofoam and chlorine. Nurse Callahan intercepted him at the elevator. "Ah, our honorary cardiology snowbird," she said, shaking a thermometer like a maraca. "Annual migration on schedule?" "Headwinds light," he answered. She snapped on the blood pressure cuff. Velcro rasped, bulb squished, numbers flipped. "Pulse is sleigh bell steady. Hollis will be smug. Up to 4. The elevator groaned. On the ward, the bulletin board sported new construction paper stockings. Lily, Rose, Maggie, glitter glue, spelling their names crooked as rivers. Room 214's door stood ajar. He pushed with 2 fingers. The ordinary bed had vanished. In its place waited a 3-foot pine sapling, planted in a galvanized bucket, root ball wrapped in damp burlap tied off with twine. Colored bulbs, identical to the ones in his store window, looped the branches, casting a warm, multicolored glow. One bulb, the blue, sputtered every few seconds. On the visitor chair sat Hollis's stethoscope, coiled around an extension cord. Jim's boot stuck to the linoleum as though nostalgia had been varnished over it. He placed the poinsettia beside the sapling. Red bracts flared against the dark needles. The bucket leaked a cool, earthy scent, wet bark, iron, buried secrets. Footsteps clicked. Dr. Hollis appeared, shrugging off a peacoat dusted in snow. His cufflinks were tiny red sleighs. "Mr. Bauer," he intoned, "I see you've located our clandestine greenhouse. You smuggled a tree past security? Technically, the loading dock. Mr. Alves declared it equipment. 1 hose, 1 mop, 1 evergreen. Hollis patted the sapling's trunk with surgical tenderness. Jim traced a bulb wire. "That blue one's got a nervous twitch." "Like all of us," Hollis said. He produced a folded memo. Speaking of nerves, the brass upstairs dispatched holiday cheer in written form. "Care for a reading?" Jim nodded, bracing himself on an IV pole repurposed as a light stand. Hollis cleared his throat. 2. Department heads. Subject: cost containment measures, non-critical ward utilization. Be advised that effective next fiscal quarter, discretionary overnight admissions will be subject to administrative pre-approval. Furthermore, seasonal decor involving live flora is considered a maintenance hazard. Signed, Gerald A. Carmichael, J.D., Acting Director of Compliance. The words clanged in the air, tin on tin, a harsh reminder of the bureaucratic machinery that led to the hospital's rules. An uneasy hush settled, as though even the fluorescent lights had paused to listen. Hollis folded the memo again, tucking it into the sapling's burlap like compost, a small act of defiance symbolizing the ward's quiet rebellion. Jim wanted to ask if the wing would close, if next Christmas he'd find the room stripped to drywall. Instead, he swallowed the question. Guilt, familiar, metallic, rose anyway. 5 hospital beds tied up by his whim across 5 decades. Marion would have barked that he was clutching what wasn't his. Pockets rattled. "Caught this trying to hitchhike to Lost and Found," Hollis said, producing a hand-carved cedar ornament, a star inside a circle, the one Jim had whittled for Marion their first married Christmas. He hadn't realized Pauline kept it safe all year. The scent hit him like a swung door to the past. Damp barn boards, saw running through cedar, Marion's braid swinging as she swept curls of wood from his boots. He rubbed the ornament, thumb finding the divot where he'd slipped with the carving knife. "She said the star looked lazy, needed sharpening," he murmured. "Lazy stars still shine," Hollis replied. "They hung it together on the sapling's highest reachable branch." The branch sagged, then steadied. Jim imagined the cedar and pine recognizing each other, distant cousins trading sap stories. Pauline slipped in, cheeks pink from the drafty stairwell. She carried a clipboard of discharge forms, baseline labs, pharmacy checklists, all blank. "Insurance likes its paperwork," she sighed. Jim borrowed her pen, signed, smelled the ink, ballpoint cheap, and returned it. Only then did he notice the smudge of blue glitter on her cheek. probably from hanging the girl's stockings. He nearly reached to brush it off, then stopped. She caught the glance, wiped the glitter with her sleeve. Maggie went rogue with the glue. How are they? Pauline's grin eased a line from her brow. Lily's building a popsicle stick empire. Rose convinced the cat to wear antlers, the usual domestic piece. He pictured their kitchen, radio static, three mismatched mugs of cocoa, stockings drooping from a radiator pipe. That he had a place in that world, if only as Tomato Man, unlocked something behind his ribs. Callahan popped her head in. Vitals, people. I need documentation before Santa clocks in. She wielded a thermometer like a sheriff's badge. Jim sat on the bed. The mattress squeaked its mouse with laryngitis complaint. Cuff hissed, thermometer ticked. Numbers normal. Hollis scribbled, winked. Pulse presents no flight risk. Forms concluded, Hollis and Callahan drifted out, trading jabs about pudding carts and reflective floors. Pauline lingered, fingertips grazing the burlap. Girls want to plant it outside the store come spring, she said. Ground'll be ready, he answered, hoping it true. The blue bulb blinked, three short, three long, three short, then steadied. Jim pretended not to notice. Get some sleep, Pauline murmured. She dimmed the overheads, leaving colored bulbs to throw soft halos on ceiling tiles. Before closing the door, she set a thermos on the nightstand. Soup, chicken, not institutional. Her pager buzzed, duty called. Alone, Jim spooned broth, tasting of thyme and a hint of lime, her experimental streak. He finished, slid under the blanket, watched the sapling shadow sway as ventilation kicked on. The cedar ornament spun, slow and easy. Eventually, the blue bulb quit blinking. Or maybe his eyes did. Sleep arrived, riding the low hum of ducts and the pine bark smell that overran disinfectant. In the narrow space between dreams, he felt Marion squeeze his shoulder once, approval or forgiveness, he couldn't tell, and then the ward fell away. Down the hall, Pauline parked herself at the deserted nurse's station, lights dimmed to let patients keep their dreams. She pulled a sheet of pharmacy letterhead and began a letter she would not mail. Dear Michael, snow again. The girls think you steer the storms. The pen skipped, ink thinned. She shook it, coaxed a reluctant flow. I watched a man hang his dead wife's ornament tonight. You'd have liked him. Keeps his grief tidy as tackle in a boat box. The tree we smuggled in smells like the coast at low tide, when the pines lean out over the dunes. Ink faded to gray. She pressed harder, words grooved but colorless. I don't know if you read these, but on the chance currents carry them, the ballpoint scraped dry. She folded the half-written page into eighths. It joined three others in her cardigan pocket. From 214, faint multicolored light spilled beneath the door, pooling on the linoleum like something alive. One bulb flickered, two shorts, pause, one short, as though the ward, stubborn as its people, refused to power down for the night. Pauline smiled at the code she couldn't translate, rubbed the pocket where unsent letters warmed her palm, and went to check the next set of vital signs before the hour turned. By mid-January, winter had tightened its iron claws around Concord. Icicles still clung to the south eave of Bauer Hardware on the third Friday of the month, their frozen tips glinting like a row of tiny swords. Jim watched a shard skitter beneath the display window, then bent for the broom, the wooden handle creaking in his hands. Two strokes, a muted grunt, and winter's litter joined the day's sweepings in his galvanized pail. Drawn breath steamed his glasses. He wiped them clear with the hem of a flannel sleeve already dusted white with rock salt. Inside, the shop smelled of thawing wool and the first shipment of seed catalogs, ink, newsprint, a whisper of mildew where a box had kissed the floor. He slit one open, let the pages fall, releasing a flutter of colorful seed packets. Cucumbers, page 43. The pictured fruit held the obedient geometry of parade rifles, straight, identical, smug. He tapped the margin with his pencil, the graphite leaving a faint mark, and wrote in the almanac margin, "Needs humbling." The pencil scratched against the paper, a soothing sound that seemed to calm his thoughts. The bell above the door jangled, and Mr. Alves stepped in, parka unzipped, mop handle jutting like a mast from the bucket at his side. His dark hair was flecked with snow, and his eyes crinkled at the corners as he smiled. "Hospital boiler cough again," he reported, accent softening every consonant, his voice a gentle rumble. "Need new valve, maybe two." The sound of his voice was a comfort, a reminder of the familiar rhythms of the community. Jim fetched the brass fittings, dropped them in a paper sack, and pressed the catalogs into Alvis's free hand. "Pick something for the courtyard beds while you're at it," he said, his eyes crinkling at the corners. He could almost feel the soil warm beneath those words. Alves chuckled, teeth flashing white against winter-rough skin, and left with steam already curling from the cup of his breath, the sound of the door closing behind him a soft whisper. Outside, the gutter hissed where ice met the first honest thaw, a gentle gurgle that seemed to signal the slow awakening of the world. Jim tilted his face to the pewter sky and imagined trellis wire humming with July weight, the image a pleasant distraction from the chill of the winter air. As he stood there, the sound of dripping water and the smell of wet earth filled his senses, and he felt a sense of hope stirring within him. April's rain tapped a sloppy rhythm on Pauline's kitchen window, blurring the lilac bushes into mauve watercolor, the sound a soothing accompaniment to her thoughts. Bills lay fanned across the formica, electric, oil, Lily's orthodontist estimate, the papers a stark reminder of the financial realities they faced. She stacked them tallest to smallest, ran her thumb down the edges, and felt the pulse in her wrist quicken, a flutter that seemed to betray her growing unease. The overtime column on her pay stub had shrunk to a single, lonely digit. Administrative trial balloon, Hollis had warned, cost containment in miniature, a phrase that had left her feeling both cautious and concerned. Her dark hair was pulled back in a loose ponytail, and her eyes were red-rimmed from lack of sleep. At the other end of the table, Maggie formed sentences from spelling words, her lips shaping each syllable like a secret code as she waited for maternal approval, though Pauline's mind was two counties away, consumed by the mounting financial worries around her. Maggie's bright pink sweater was a splash of color in the drab kitchen, and her tongue poked out of the corner of her mouth as she concentrated. Pauline pressed her thumb to the bridge of her nose, feeling the tension build. "Go ahead, honey. Capital D, then." Her voice trailed off, a gentle prompt that was both distracted and encouraging. "Is tant," Maggie finished, her shoulders lifting with the triumph of permission, a small smile playing on her lips. Coins clinked. Pauline was back to sorting the mason jar of laundry quarters when Lily burst in, cheeks windburned, a postcard waving overhead, her eyes shining with excitement. Rose followed, waving a smaller scrap, a doodle Jim had drawn of a tomato wearing galoshes, the image a whimsical touch that captured the playful spirit of the season. Lily's bright blue coat was zipped up to her chin, and her hair was wine-tangled. Pauline's first instinct was to remind them of chores, a habitual response lingering from a different time. Her second, stronger, warmer, was to picture their sneakers grass-stained instead of scuffing linoleum, a pleasant image that brought a sense of joy. She folded the oil bill in half, then half again, and smoothed the crease flat, a small gesture mingling resignation with resolve. "We'll pack sandwiches," she said, and Maggie's pencil skittered off the line in giddy agreement, the sound a small celebration. July scorched the Concord community plots until even the scarecrows slumped, the air thick with heat and the scent of dry earth. Jim, his cap shading his flushed ears, watched Lily and Rose tip a dented watering can over the cucumber row, the sound of water a gentle accompaniment to their laughter. Vines curled green and proud along the wire, heavy with fruit that should have dangled straight as carpenter's levels. They did not. Instead, each cucumber swooped in a perfect curve before hooking back on itself, an army of emerald question marks punctuating the soil, a surreal sight that seemed to defy explanation. Jim plucked the largest, turned it in his palm, and could almost hear the whispered query, "What on earth happened?" The sensation was a mixture of confusion and amusement. The sun beat down on his back, and the smell of fresh earth and growing plants filled his nostrils. Pauline arrived late, hair escaping its ribbon, her face flushed from the heat. She flicked sweat from her freckles and eyed the malformed crop, a wry smile playing on her lips. "Did you read them Kierkegaard aloud at night?" she teased, her voice a gentle jab. Her eyes sparkled with amusement, and her skin glistened with sweat. "No, ma'am," Jim answered, deadpan, his eyes crinkling at the corners. "Must be the philosophical mulch." He sliced one open with his penknife. Seeds glistened like wet punctuation, a tiny detail that captured the essence of the moment. The girls collapsed in laughter, Maggie's shoelaces dragging through the dust as she tried to straighten a specimen with both hands, the sound a joyful noise. It sprang back, defiant, a small act of rebellion that testified to the whimsy of the season. They filled a crate, curved cucumbers, crooked smiles, and Jim loaded it into the half-ton, the sound of metal creaking a familiar note. "Hospital salad bar won't know what hit 'em," he said, wiping his neck with a bandana stained grass green, a gesture mingling pride with amusement. Pauline pretended to groan. Her eyes, though, danced like rainwater catching sun, a warm smile capturing the moment's joy. September delivered its own hard edge, the air crisp and cool. In conference room B, the windowless one with the clock that ticked 2 seconds slow, Hollis sat at the polished mahogany, a legal pad angled precisely, cuffs unbuttoned for air, a picture of calm deliberation. His spectacles slipped down his nose, and his eyes were fixed intently on Carmichael. Across from him, Gerald A. Carmichael, J.D., clicked a fountain pen so loudly it could have been a metronome of annoyance, the sound a stark contrast to the quiet of the room. Between them, a glass pitcher sweated onto a coaster that read, "Property of Dietary Services," a mundane detail grounding the scene. Hollis opened with courtesy so fine it nearly sliced skin, his voice a gentle breeze on a summer day. "Gerald, we appear to be speaking parallel dialects of stewardship." He slid forward a spreadsheet, colored neatly in Hollis green highlighter, a subtle touch capturing his attention to detail. "Cost per elective overnight in Wing C has fallen 11% since patient garden walks were instituted," he noted, a statistic testifying to the power of their efforts. Carmichael adjusted his tie by the millimeter, his eyes narrowing slightly. "Wing C remains a square footage liability. One burst pipe, and our operating margin drowns." His smile never reached his eyes, a small detail betraying his true feelings. His tailored suit gleamed in the fluorescent light, and his voice was a cold, precise instrument. Hollis reached for the pitcher and poured deliberately, the ice cubes clinking like distant cathedral bells, a soothing sound. "Water?" he offered, his voice a gentle courtesy. Carmichael declined, his eyes fixed on the drip sliding down the pitcher's spine, his expression a mixture of distaste and disapproval. "We will circulate a memorandum. Non-essential admissions will terminate by November 1st, with special scrutiny on holiday exceptions," he pronounced, "a harbinger of change." Hollis sipped, his eyes never leaving Carmichael's face, a quiet challenge testifying to his resolve. "Your pen, Gerald," he said softly, "is admirably sharp. Remember, though, ink doesn't cauterize loneliness, a phrase capturing the essence of their disagreement." "Nor does sentiment balance ledgers, doctor," the lawyer retorted, his voice a cold counterpoint to Hollis's warmth. He capped the pen, verdict signed, a small gesture symbolizing their differing perspectives. The memo landed in mail slots 3 weeks before Thanksgiving, its presence a stark reminder of the challenges they faced. Black type, no room for interpretation. Effective 24 Dec 1966, all non-critical admissions require pre-approval. No exemptions. Jim read the copied sheet in the break room while his coffee turned to sludge, the bitter taste a jolt to his system. Pauline stood beside him, her cardigan sleeve twisted twice, then tighter, a small gesture betraying her growing unease. Callahan drifted in with a tray of gelatin cups and let the door thud shut behind her, the sound a soft punctuation mark. Her bright red uniform was a splash of color in the drab break room, and her eyes were sympathetic. "Can't they leave one night alone?" she murmured, her voice pitched low enough that even the humming fridge swallowed it, a quiet complaint capturing the room's mood. Rose's school catalog, fundraiser for playground swings, lay forgotten on the counter, a mundane reminder of the world outside. Lily wedged it under the knob, an accidental doorstop that suddenly felt strategic, a small act of defiance testifying to their resourcefulness. Hollis entered next, jacket off, shirt sleeves rolled, his eyes scanning the room with quiet understanding. He surveyed the faces, the barricaded door, and nodded once, as though a chess piece had just moved exactly as predicted, a small gesture symbolizing their quiet planning. "No minutes, no quorum," he said, hands clasped behind his back, a gentle reminder of their unofficial gathering. "Therefore, hypothetically, we are not planning anything," he added, his tone a mix of humor and caution. Pauline reached for the instant coffee spoon and tapped it twice on the mug's rim, a small signal. "Hypothetically," she echoed, "if a certain tomato enthusiast found himself spiritually distressed..." Her voice trailed off, a gentle prompt mingling suggestion with inquiry. "Observation status," Hollis finished, his eyes glinting behind slipping spectacles, a small smile playing on his lips. "Billing code 716.B. I'd sign it," he added, a testament to their quiet understanding. Jim's grin unfurled slow as dawn, a warm smile capturing the moment's joy. "Doctor, I might even feel shaped like one," he said, crooking an arm into the cucumber's curve, a whimsical gesture celebrating their playful spirit. Callahan's laugh popped free like a champagne cork, a joyful sound celebrating their small rebellion. The catalog under the door creaked but held, a small act of defiance symbolizing their determination. Footsteps passed in the hall, Carmichael's, likely, brisk as a gavel, but the plotting remained half-spoken, buoyed by the clatter of spoons and the low whir of the vending machine, a soothing background hum. Outside, a late maple leaf slapped the window, its black vein against a gray sky, as though signing its own quiet endorsement, a small gesture testifying to the power of their quiet resolve. November dusk settled early, yet inside the break room, filaments of defiant warmth wound among them. No fanfare, no pledges, just the subtle click of unspoken gears and quiet planning that testified to their resourcefulness. Plans would bloom later, under safer lights, but the seed was planted, crooked, stubborn, shaped like a question mark, and absolutely determined to grow. By Christmas Eve, that seed pressed upward through snow. Snow lacquered the hood of Jim's half-ton in a thin glaze that squeaked when he palmed it for balance. The cold air stung his wind-bitten cheeks as he stepped out of the truck, the sound of the engine dying away into the stillness of Christmas Eve 1966. He killed the engine, let the heater fan wheeze to silence, and studied the front entrance of Emerson Hospital, the revolving door a blur of motion as it cycled precisely every 4 seconds, spitting out visiting relatives in wool overcoats, swallowing anxious interns, whirring on. Up on the third floor, a row of fluorescents snapped awake in sequence. Click, 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 then steadied, throwing long watchdog rectangles across the courtyard snow, the light casting an eerie glow on the ground. Jim eased from the cab, tucked a cinnamon toothpick between molars, and fished the envelope from his coat, the familiar weight a comfort. Inside waited the fresh mint chart Dr. Hollis had mailed that morning. Blank, except for the admission code already typed, 716B, observation, spiritual distress. The Bauer Hardware logo, printed faintly on the back, ghosted through the paper like a forger's watermark, a subtle reminder of the subterfuge. He slipped the envelope beneath his arm and walked, the sound of his footsteps echoing through the stillness. Mr. Alves, his dark hair slicked back, buffed the lobby floor in slow orbits, machine humming like a distant propeller, the scent of wax and polish filling the air. He caught Jim's eye, gave an almost invisible nod, and steered the buffer left to create a dry path straight to the elevator. The tiles so glossy, Jim glimpsed the sag of his shoulders in them, a fleeting reflection of his own weariness. The fourth floor doors parted on a hush, broken only by the rubber whisper of a security guard's soles, the man's eyes scanning the area with a mixture of curiosity and suspicion. Nurse Callahan, her bright red uniform a splash of color in the drab hallway, waved a clipboard in his face. "Lost delivery," she said brightly. "Christmas rush." The guard harumphed, disappeared down the orthopedic wing, and Callahan winked, her eyes crinkling at the corners. "Runway's clear, Mr. Bauer." Room 2014 already smelled of discreet rebellion, cinnamon candles hidden in coffee cups, a single strand of colored bulbs stapled to the ceiling grid, and a reckless touch, a fist-sized red ornament dangling from the sprinkler pipe, the air thick with the scent of cinnamon and a hint of mischief. Pauline waited with the intake forms, her cardigan sleeve twisted near to death, her eyes warm with a quiet understanding. Her constellation of freckles across the bridge of her nose stood out in the fluorescent light. "Shoes off, gown on," she ordered, Boston vowels softened by nerves. "And don't complain about the draft. Administration says gowns build character." Jim undid his laces, felt the plank-cold linoleum bite through his socks, and tried not to shiver, the cold a jolt to his system. "Character's overrated." She smacked the chart onto a wheeled table, carbon pages fanning like a magician's deck. The sound, a stark reminder of the bureaucratic machinery that governed the hospital. One copy stamped pink, one yellow, one white for Mr. Carmichael's precious files, the colors a code that only they understood. Her pen hovered. "Symptom onset?" He swallowed, the dryness in his throat a palpable sensation. "Lonely at 1800, worsened by hymns in minor keys." Click went the ballpoint, the sound a small punctuation mark. "Box checked. Legal." She tore along the perforation so fast the carbon squealed, the sound a harsh contrast to the quiet of the room. "Sign here, initial there, and you, sir, are officially distressed." He scrawled J.H. Bauer, the pen wobbling a little, half from chill, half from the reckless joy of the thing, a sense of liberation washing over him. Footsteps, lighter, pattering. Lily, Rose, and Maggie tumbled in wearing felt Santa hats that tilted sideways like drunk sailors, their bright pink sweaters a splash of color in the drab hospital. Silver bells were sewn to their sneakers with embroidery floss. Every step jingled out of sync, the sound a joyful accompaniment to their antics. Rose lugged a cardboard box stenciled the three wise tomatoes, props. Lily clutched cue cards lettered in crayon. Maggie brandished a rubber reindeer nose that squeaked each time she squeezed it for emphasis, her eyes shining with mischief. Pauline put a finger to her lips. "Hallway patrol every 15. Skit starts at 19:30 sharp. If Carmichael's on prowl, you pivot to plan B." Lily saluted, bells chiming. "Roger that, Nurse Mom." The cue cards immediately slipped from her arm, fanning across the floor like startled birds, creating a small commotion. Maggie dove in, retrieving them with exaggerated stealth, while the reindeer nose let out a forlorn bleat that made Callahan snort laugh behind her chart. A warm, gentle sound. 7:30 rang from the distant chapel carillon, a solemn, measured accompaniment to the unfolding scene. Jim sat on the edge of the bed, his gown gaping at knobby knees, and watched as the girls transformed the substitute solarium, a conference nook they'd hijacked while facilities counted ceiling tiles, into a festive stage. Fold-up chairs became camel backs. A deflated beach ball painted gold served as the East Star, and on a tea-towel-draped TV cart rested the pièce de résistance. Three early girl tomatoes, each adorned with a construction paper crown, their bright colors a welcome respite from the ward's drabness. Lily cleared her throat. "Cue card one. Lo, we are juicy and wise." Rose bowed with theatrical gravity. "We travel bearing condiments. Salt, pepper, and the mystery of compost." Maggie forgot her line, beamed, and improvised. and coupons for free salad at the cafeteria until forever. The reindeer nose squeaked to punctuate forever, a small, joyful punctuation mark. Even Callahan, offstage prompter, lost her composure, shoulders shaking with a warm, gentle laugh that captured the moment's joy. The audience, including Dr. Rowe, Hollis, his novelty cufflinks depicted tiny manger scenes, and two elderly patients wheeled in from 212 and 216, watched with faces aglow with delight. Both ladies clapped with arthritic enthusiasm, their applause a testament to their appreciation. The colored bulbs overhead pulsed red, green, blue, tinting everything with a soft circus hue, a whimsical touch that matched the mood of the ward. Halfway through Lily's monologue about the miracle of perpetual marinara, Jim's breath snagged, a sudden sharp pain that stole his breath away. A single muscle behind his sternum tightened, then spasmed, as if someone had hooked a wire and pulled it, a jolt coursing through him. He set a palm to his chest, forcing a casual posture even as his airways shortened into a shallow, ragged gasp. Not a heart attack. Most likely, he'd read enough pamphlets, a wry thought that offered a small comfort. Stress, cold floor, excitement, a rational explanation that did little to allay his fear. Pauline noticed first, her eyes warm with concern. She knelt, fingers cool on his wrist, drew a count, her touch a gentle reassurance. Deep breaths, Jim. In for 4, out for 6. He tried, each breath a labored effort. In, half, out, barely. His gown fluttered uselessly against him, a flimsy barrier against the pain. His vision pricked black around the edges. The bulb string above seemed to sizzle, a kaleidoscope of colors blurring together. Dr. Hollis stepped forward and took command like a maestro silencing brass, his voice smooth and authoritative. Children, finale pose, please. Nurse Callahan, wheel Mr. Bauer back to 214 at an unhurried pace. His tone was sanded smooth yet decisive, a gentle, firm direction. Rose's lip trembled, a small, vulnerable gesture. Did we break him? Not remotely, Hollis replied, squeezing her shoulder in a gesture of comfort. He's simply overwhelmed by your artistry. Jim managed a crooked thumbs up as Callahan engaged the brake on a rolling walker and steered him out, the bell's sound fading into a gentle diminuendo. Hallway fluorescence buzzed louder than usual, as if tattling, a harsh counterpoint to the room's prior quiet. Shadows of the evening security patrol prowled at the far end, a reminder of watchful eyes. When they entered 214, Hollis was waiting with a portable monitor already aglow in blue, a stark emblem of the hospital's sterility. Leads on, cuffs pumped, and numbers appeared. Pulse racing yet steady, oxygen modestly low. Nothing catastrophic, just fear playing puppeteer with aging nerves, a wry thought that brought a small comfort. Hollis murmured, "You'll outlive us all," then adjusted the flow meter to 2 liters, tucking in the cannula with a gentle, reassuring touch. 10 minutes and you rejoin the encore. Just then, Gerald A. Carmichael, J.D., slick as an oiled hinge, strode through the partially closed door, his eyes scanning the room with a mix of curiosity and suspicion. His tie, a discipline of crimson silk, sat half a millimeter askew, a small detail betraying his fastidious nature. We slip behind Hollis's glasses now, a subtle shift capturing the tension of the moment. Carmichael pinched the knot, straightened it, and let his gaze sweep over the contraband bulbs, the sapling's year-old shadow preserved on the far wall, and the tomato crowns abandoned on the tray table, his expression a blend of disapproval and annoyance. "Doctor," he said, his voice like polished granite, "explain the carnival." He produced the pink copy of Jim's chart, the paper a stark reminder of the bureaucratic machinery that governed the hospital. Observation, spiritual distress. Ingenious code, but the party 2 rooms over violates at least 3 fire ordinances and 1 administrative memo. Hollis felt his spectacles slip and nudged them back with a knuckle. A small, habitual gesture. Carmichael, Hospital Charter Section 11, Paragraph 4. Provision shall be made for the cultural and spiritual comfort of all admitted persons, provided safety standards are upheld. Tonight's comfort happens to involve horticultural pageantry. Carmichael's pen clicked open, metallic and accusatory, a harsh punctuation to his disapproval. Your comfort involves open flame. He pointed to the cinnamon candle hissing on the dresser, its flame a small, defiant presence. Hollis blew it out with a mild puff, the sound a soft, gentle whisper. Flame resolved, clause remains. Wing C is understaffed, Carmichael pressed, his voice a cold, precise instrument. Yet fully monitored, Hollis returned in a smooth, measured tone. I, for instance, am on duty. He splayed his hands, his cufflinks glinting with nativity gold, a whimsical touch capturing the season's essence. Carmichael's gaze slid to the monitor behind Jim, his eyes scanning pulse and O2 with a blend of curiosity and professional detachment. One slip, doctor, and liability will bury us. Then allow me to keep the patient calm, Hollis said, his voice gentleman smooth yet iron cored, a gentle firmness in his reassurance. Anxiety elevates risk far more than papier-mâché crowns. He stepped closer, quietly obscuring Carmichael's view of Jim's vulnerable, eavesdropping face, a subtle testament to his compassion. Gerald, he added in a tone reserved for old colleagues, let the night finish. At dawn, you may draft memos until your fountain pen begs mercy. Carmichael's tie straightened again, a micro gesture of resignation. He exhaled through his nose, already filing future briefs with a wry air of professionalism. One candle and the children gone by curfew, nothing more. He pocketed the chart copy, his heels clicking a decisive retreat. The door shut. The monitor beeped a lazy sinus rhythm, a soothing cadence to the ensuing stillness. Hollis allowed himself a breath of relief before returning to his patient's side of the chessboard, his eyes warm with quiet understanding. Back in Jim's perspective, with cool oxygen against his nostrils, he heard distant applause, a joyful, muffled sound suggesting the girls had improvised a finale without him. Good. He flexed his fingers. The pain receded to a dull stitch, a small, comforting sensation. Minutes later, Lily poked her head in, her eyes shining with excitement. Encore demands your presence, Mr. Jim, she whispered, noticing the cannula. Better? Better. He confirmed, his voice sandpaper but true, a small reassuring smile touching his lips. They returned to the solarium for curtain call. Two elderly ladies waved white napkins while Maggie tossed hole punch confetti rescued from some clerk's waste basket, the colorful bits drifting onto the waxed linoleum like lazy snow, a whimsical touch that captured the essence of the season. Final tableau, the tomatoes held aloft, Maggie squeaking the reindeer nose one victorious time, the sound a small, joyful punctuation mark. Lily announced, and they offered him ketchup everlasting. Everyone cheered, even Dr. Hollis, in a warm, joyful celebration that perfectly captured the moment's delight. When the audience dispersed, patients rolled back, children herded, Pauline knelt with a dustpan, sweeping stray confetti and restoring the ward's decorum before the dawn inspection, her movements sure, economical, and relentlessly kind. She hummed, Silent Night, so softly that the words barely formed, a gentle, soothing murmur. Jim watched her hands at work. Sure, economical, relentless in kindness. He leaned close, his whisper rasping past a dry throat in a small, intimate gesture. Worth every crooked cucumber, he said. Pauline smiled without turning, and the colored bulbs reflected in a tear she didn't bother to hide, a small, telling detail. Behind her, the confetti continued skittering under the broom, as though it, too, refused to leave before morning, a whimsical touch capturing the very essence of the season. Sunrise found the ward quieter, but no less determined. Morning light crept into room 214, illuminating the remnants of the previous night's rebellion. Tinsel clung to wool poles like stubborn holiday refuse, and the staff moved with a mix of wariness and triumph as they began to strip away the contraband decorations. Breakfast trays clattered, a mundane sound that grounded the ward in routine once more. Pauline, her dark hair tied back in a loose bun, supervised the cleanup with a soft smile, her Boston accent gentle as she directed the nurses. Jim, already dressed in his street clothes, watched from the doorway, his wind-bitten cheeks creased in a quiet smile as he fingered the wool cap pulled low over his forehead. The days that followed were a blur of activity. Jim's garden proposal went before the town hall, where it faced skeptical gazes and cookie-crumbled gavels. In the echoing chambers, Counselor Mrs. Jenkins cupped a hand around her ear, mishearing herbs as herbs, prompting Hollis to clarify, his baritone soothing, "We propose a sensory garden, ma'am, with herbs and flowers to soothe the patients." The gavel landed with a splat in a tray of abandoned cookies, and Jim's nervous habit resurfaced as he chewed on a cinnamon toothpick. The vote was close, but the proposal passed, and the hospital courtyard was slated for transformation. As the garden took shape, the sounds of construction filled the air. The squeak of wheelbarrows, the chatter of the crew, and the occasional bleat of a therapy rabbit that had escaped its enclosure and was nibbling on parsley shoots. Lily, Pauline's eldest, designed a wooden sign that creaked in the breeze, while Mr. Alves, the hospital's maintenance chief, strung fairy lights through the new planters, his high-gloss floors forgotten in the excitement. Dr. Hollis, sporting novelty cufflinks shaped like tiny gardening gloves, coordinated the volunteers, his spectacles slipping down his nose as he laughed at the antics of the therapy rabbit. The local press arrived one afternoon, flashbulbs popping as they captured the garden's progress. Hollis quipped, "Our patients need thyme," and the reporter, her fingers chilly as she scribbled notes, smiled at the pun. Jim, standing amidst the budding greenery, beamed with pride, his eyes crinkling at the corners. By Christmas 1967, the garden was a haven. Cocoa steamed in mittened hands as the staff and patients gathered beneath the first snowfall of the season. Jim sat on a bench, writing letters to be sealed and stored for future lonely hearts, the ink blot forming on one page like a tiny snowflake as he paused to watch the flakes settle on the wheelchairs, soft as powdered sugar. Pauline sat beside him, her freckles standing out in the cold, her cardigan twisted in a fidget as she listened to the laughter and the soft murmur of conversation. A year later, Jim sealed envelopes marked "Open When Lonely," the words a gentle reminder of the ritual that had grown in the garden. As he worked, the memory of his wife's handwriting on old receipt pads surfaced, a bittersweet echo that he cherished. The letters, like the garden, were a testament to the power of small, luminous acts of kindness in the darkest of times. Years slipped ahead, snowy pages turning. Snow fell in deliberate hushes, thick enough to muffle the clamor of Route 2, so that Concord sounded, for a rare hour, like countryside again. The flakes danced around the streetlights, their delicate forms illuminated by the sodium glow, casting a serene ambiance over the quiet streets. Pauline parked in the staff lot, the crunch of gravel beneath her tires, a familiar sound that brought a sense of comfort. She sat for a moment, watching the flakes organize themselves on the windshield, their intricate patterns a testament to the beauty of the natural world. At this distance, each one looked perfectly whole, but the wiper's first sweep would prove how fragile they were. 41, with silver beginning to infiltrate her hairline, she felt the cold less in her skin than in her joints. Nevertheless, she welcomed it. Snow, like hospital night shift, had always granted her a pardon from ordinary noise. Boots found the crusted pavement with a satisfying crunch. The sound echoed through the stillness as she made her way to the hospital's side entrance. Across the street, the old Bauer Hardware sign, now an antiques co-op run by Rose's college roommate, flickered in and out beneath a halo of sodium light, its gentle glow a reminder of the changing times and the memories that lingered. Pauline tightened her scarf, the wool soft against her skin, and started toward the entrance, a peppermint sting already visible in the lobby's air column where heat met cold. The revolving door coughed her inside, and winter was replaced by the mingled scents of waxed linoleum and those cinnamon-strength cough drops Hollis still swore by, a familiar aroma that brought a sense of warmth. The lobby looked borrowed from a train station, program leaflets, a borrowed mic stand, a perky potted poinsettia on the receptionist's desk, its bright red bracts a splash of color in the drab surroundings. Someone, likely Alves, had buffed the tiles to mirrors. She could make out the tired slouch of her shoulders in them as she crossed to the elevator. A poster on an easel read, "Dedication, Jim's Garden Alcove, 3 p.m. sharp," and under that, a smaller line in Hollis's steady hand, "All souls welcome, even consultants." The elevator's soft hum and the scent of polished wood filled the air as she rode it to the fourth floor, the gentle motion a soothing balm. The doors parted onto a corridor of muffled bustle, a squealing supply cart, the distant ping of a call light, muffled laughter from radiology, where no good joke ever stayed secret for long. Nurse Callahan materialized from the medication room, her silver bun so tight it might survive a tornado, her eyes crinkling at the corners as she smiled. "Afternoon, Mercado. Floors so shiny they blinded two interns already. Alves is beside himself with joy." Her pun came as naturally as pulse checks now, a gentle tease that put Pauline at ease. Callahan's eyes sparkled with mirth, and her voice was warm with a hint of mischief. Pauline sniffed theatrically. "If I slip, I'm billing for glitter damage." They walked together toward the double doors that opened onto the courtyard, the sound of their footsteps echoing through the stillness. Through the small glass panes, she could see the garden under its quilt of snow, raised cedar beds, dormant rosemary hedges, and at the far corner, a freshly varnished bench whose backboard bore a discreet brass plaque. Letters the size of thumbnails read, "James H. Bauer, ever he planted, ever we grew." The plaque seemed to glow in the soft light, a testament to Jim's legacy. The snow-covered garden was a serene and peaceful oasis, a haven from the hustle and bustle of the hospital. Hollis waited just inside, straightening a narrow tie patterned with microscopic rakes and trowels, his eyes warm with a quiet understanding. His spectacles fogged when he greeted them. He cleaned them on a monogrammed handkerchief, revealing cufflinks shaped like copper watering cans, a whimsical touch that captured the season's essence. "Ladies," he said, voice still tuned to that resonant baritone despite the flecks of white in his beard, "our modest ceremony begins when marketing finds the mayor or the mayor finds parking, whichever miracle occurs first." Callahan produced two paper cups of cider from somewhere behind her clipboard, the scent of apple and cinnamon filling the air. "Liquid patience. And it's sugar-free, so administration won't cite us for irresponsible merriment." The cider was a warm and comforting presence, a small gesture that brought a sense of camaraderie. A new patient, a wiry man in a navy peacoat, oxygen tubing tucked neatly over his ears, was struggling with a folded page, his eyes scanning the words with a mixture of curiosity and confusion. Pauline excused herself and crossed the hall, her footsteps quiet on the polished floor. "Need a translator?" she asked, already recognizing the stationery's faded tomato leaf stain, a subtle reminder of Jim's thoughtful gestures. The man handed over the letter, and Pauline began reading aloud, low enough for only their little circle. "Dear stranger, if you are on the mend, God keep you steady. If you are waiting on news, may it be kinder than the waiting itself. In either case, the soil knows what to do with winter. Rest now, grow later. P.S. Ask a nurse for tea. They hide the good packets on the second shelf." The words seemed to take on a life of their own, a gentle reassurance that filled the small space. The man's eyes glossed over, and the younger volunteer pressed fingertips to her own mouth, a small gesture of empathy. Pauline folded the letter carefully and handed it back, her eyes warm with understanding. "He wrote dozens of these. Would you like to keep it until you're discharged?" The offer was a kind and gentle gesture, a small act of kindness that brought a sense of comfort. As the ceremony began, Alves wheeled out a dolly stacked with folding chairs, muttering at the salt stains on his boots, the sound a mundane reminder of the world's realities. The teen volunteer joined him, humming "Silent Night" off key while she tugged chair legs into symmetry, the gentle, soothing sound a balm to the soul. Hollis spoke briefly, his voice pitched for snowfall, a gentle, measured tone that seemed to match the mood of the occasion. "Some men mend walls. Jim mended Winters. When grief pressed, he answered with green things. May this spot do the same for whoever sits here next. The words were a poignant reminder of Jim's legacy, a testament to the impact he had on those around him. Pauline stepped forward, her gloved hand resting on the bench's back, a gentle touch that seemed to symbolize her quiet compassion. Jim once told me, gardens are conversations you start but never finish. So if you're out here in July and the time looks thirsty, he's asking for a sip of water. In December, when the snow blankets everything, he's reminding you rest matters too. The words seem to take on a life of their own, a testament to Jim's enduring legacy. As she spoke, the snow-covered garden seemed to come alive, a peaceful and serene presence that filled the air. As the mayor cut the ribbon, a shutter clicked, capturing the moment, the sound a small punctuation mark. People drifted, chairs scraped, and Alves wheeled out a tub of hospital pudding, now festively topped with nutmeg, the scent a warm, comforting presence. Callahan sidled up, pressing a cedar-scented ornament into Pauline's palm, the familiar shape a tangible connection to the past. It was the star inside a circle, the same Marion-carved cedar Jim had hung a decade earlier, a small poignant reminder of the memories that lingered. Pauline turned toward the rosemary bed, where the teen volunteer still hummed Silent Night, the gentle, soothing sound a balm to the soul. Together, they hung the ornament where the herb released its clean, pungent scent, a primal aroma that transported Pauline to a different time. Cedar and rosemary, one memory, one promise, swung lightly in the courtyard breeze, a gentle, peaceful presence. The volunteer stepped back, hands jammed in coat pockets, a small, contented smile on her face. He'd like that spot, she whispered, her voice a gentle, soothing murmur. Pauline looked up, flakes settling on the girl's eyelashes, the garden lamp haloing her like candlelight, a warm, golden glow. He would, she agreed, voice almost lost to the snow-silenced air, a small, quiet smile on her face. The chatter around them drifted away, leaving only the soft sound of snowfall and the gentle hum of the hymn, a peaceful, serene presence that seemed to fill the world. As they stood there, the snow continued to fall, a gentle reminder of the beauty and tranquility of the moment. Pauline smiled, quiet and complete, as the scene widened until only snow and soft hymn humming remained. Thank you for choosing Astory Publishing.